Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. First, just to make sure, is it Kato?
Kato.
Okay, that's why I wanted to make sure. I didn't want to be calling you the Green Hornets plan.
Exactly. Kato.
I'm sure you've gotten that a lot over the years, though.
I have. Like, I went to school in North Carolina. Everybody, hey, Kato. So I just gave up.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to include that because I think that's, you know, just funny based on human interaction.
Of course.
So this is the newest episode of the Rock and Roll Ghost podcast. We have Chef Gene Kato from Momotaro. He's the executive chef there, part of the Boca Group. I mean, just look up the Boca Group and you'll see a litany of amazing restaurants. And as a personal note, just as a way to start this, I had the pleasure of finally visiting Momotaro on Friday, and Chef, hands down, top five meals of my life.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
I wish I could go there every night.
But we're open every night, so you have that opportunity.
Yeah, you guys certainly are, but I don't have that kind of money to eat the way I did that night at the very least. And I am a horrible glutton when I go out to restaurants. And I came out just so pleased. And there's a bunch of stuff I want to talk about that I did, was able to eat, that I'd like some insight on. But originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, as you mentioned, what brought you to Chicago initially?
So right before Chicago, I was with a group Charlotte, North Carolina, called Harper's Restaurant Group. And I had helped them open up a Pacific Rim restaurant there in Charlotte. And then we had an opportunity to open one in Charleston, South Carolina. So I went down there to open the Charleston location. And by that time, I knew that I wanted to do my own place. And I wanted to go to New York and do my own place. My mentality was, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
Especially, it was a mecca. It's still, I consider, the mecca of the food cities in America, right?
Right.
So I was really shooting for New York during that time, and I hired a headhunter. And then my headhunter was actually based in Chicago. And she had asked me, well, what about, I had some bad meetings in New York. The energy and the personality, you know, it was very, New York was very aggressive for me. And the people that I met, I didn't see a future with.
Right.
So she had brought up, oh, well, what about Chicago? And I'm like, well, I haven't really thought about Chicago. But during that time, Charlie Trotter was becoming really famous. He had just put out his first cookbook. Rick Bayless was already pretty well known. So I was like, wow, you know, Chicago's, you know, not a bad idea too. So her fiance's friend had a concept to open up a sake lounge. And she already had a sushi restaurant here in Chicago. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mirai Sushi.
No, I don't even know if I've heard of it, honestly.
Okay, so it's been around Chicago for a long time. It's one of the main Japanese restaurants that really catapulted the popularity of sushi in Chicago.
Okay.
So anyway, she had an idea to do a sake lounge, Chicago's first sake lounge, sake-based concept. So then my headhunter had connected the two of us together, and we started talking, and our principles and philosophies really matched. We really connected right from the get-go. So she provided me the opportunity to partner with her to open up the sake lounge.
Okay.
And so it just felt like a natural, the right decision to make. So I left Charleston, drove up to Chicago. I was like 25 at the time, and opened up Oba. It was called Oba Restaurant.
Okay, yeah.
It was an ADC restaurant. And we're, you know, doing izakaya food, really food that was meant to pair well with sake. There wasn't any restaurants really that was focused on sake or introducing a large list for sake at the time. This is, oh God, maybe 17 years ago, 18 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was really exciting to be able to showcase that concept. So that's what brought me to Chicago.
Yeah.
So we had opened Oba for a year. And then after that, we had the opportunity to, and she had a sushi restaurant called Mirai, like I said, at the time already. And so then we had an opportunity to open up a Japanese concept on a large scale. Nobody had really done that before in Chicago.
Right.
And so from that came Japonais, mm-hmm. Which was a huge phenomenon, you know, in Chicago.
Right, yeah, no, I remember being in Vegas at one point with my ex-wife, and we walked into one of those giant, you know, places, and there it was. And I was like, well, I didn't even know there. I mean, that was at the time, I think I was writing about food. I was like, I had no concept that you guys were in Las Vegas at the time.
Right, it was in the Mirage.
Right, yeah. The Mirage, yes.
Yep. So that was really like when we were like catapulting the concept Japonais all over, right? We had opened New York and Vegas. Actually, it ended up working out like 2 weeks apart because Vegas was so quick on their build out that they caught up with our planned opening for New York. So they were only like 2 weeks apart, but you know,
it's one of those stressful.
Yeah, it was very stressful, but it was one of those perfect place at the perfect time kind of scenario. You know, with restaurants, it's a lot of luck that's involved in having a successful restaurant, right? And I felt Japonais was the perfect storm. It was the right place. You know, we had a huge celebrity following. The space was beautiful. People, you know, really enjoyed the food that we were doing there. It was an awesome experience. And then from there to open up, you know, New York and Las Vegas.
So Japonais was, used to be on Chicago over by the bridge, right?
Correct.
That building.
Yep. Across from the Chicago Tribune.
I think my son actually was working there as a waiter at one point after you had gone.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure at what point he was there. I don't know, because I know they were ended up doing something with Morimoto, right?
Right. Yeah. So the last 2 years, Japonais Chicago was open. Well, that's when Morimoto had partnered with the existing partners.
Yeah, that was I remember that being a big deal. But now the building's kind of still just sitting there. Nothing's. It's an odd place for a restaurant in some regards too. You know?
Yep. Actually, it's a kind of funny story. So one of the owners here, he opened up with a group of other individuals to open up. It's called Beyond in the Japonais space. Mm-hmm. So it's this super high end, man, what would you call it? It's a gym, but there's like doctors on site, you know, they're doing all, you know, yoga and therapy, you know, acupuncture, just like everything that you could consider, you know, at the highest level within that spot.
They got sushi there too?
So I helped them do a small, because there's a small restaurant in there.
I was thinking it was just a gym, and I thought I was making a joke.
No.
It's the only way to get me into a gym is if they're offering food.
they have like rooms for members to sleep in, and I mean it's like
really
the options that they have there. But
Wow.
So there's a food, there's a restaurant there for members to eat. And obviously it's food health focused. So I helped them do a sushi program over there. I think
the sushi
program is not there now, but.
Okay, initially.
Yep, initially they did have a sushi program.
Well, and then at some point after, while you were at Japan A, you began thinking about your own place, which ended up being Sumi Robata.
Correct.
And I remember, the problem with restaurants in Chicago is that at some point, especially when I was writing about them, there became so many. And it's like, especially writing about them, you kind of had to stay when I was writing for Eater and Thrillist, you had to stay on top of everything new, which always kind of irritated me because I always wanted to, you know, I found myself stuck at something new opening up when I wanted to go check out something else. And unfortunately, I never got a chance to go to Sumi.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. Everybody loved it. Everybody talked about how much they loved it. And obviously, you know, there had to be something that wasn't completely right because you ended up closing. Was it the rent? What was the deal there?
Yeah, so ultimately it was the rent. The landlord had doubled. So I had a 20-year lease to renew and an option to renew every 5 years. So yeah. When my first 5 year was coming close to an end, they were going to raise my double my rent.
That's insane.
Which is unbelievable, unrealistic. I was only a 35 seat restaurant,
right? You know,
so a small mom and pop restaurant, and I showed them my numbers. I'm like, there is no way, you know. Always a great tenant, whatever. And so anyway, I knew the restaurant would not. There's no way for me to be sustainable. So I ended up having to make a tough decision and close the restaurant.
I have to imagine that was a tough decision because, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't have customers. You had all the customers you could put into that space. You know, it was very highly regarded. It was a place that I know other chefs always talked about how much they liked it.
Yep.
There's not so much, there wasn't so much of that around at the time, you know, quite honestly.
Right. So that concept, you know, I think a lot of chefs have that goal of opening up their own place. So for me, I had that goal, but the reason for that was I felt that it was the ultimate test as a chef to see how where you are with everything that you've learned, right? Food, obviously, that you're passionate about and that you have your own philosophy toward. The concept and how you're going to relate that concept to the guests, right? With everything, not just the food, but the beverage program and, you know, how you manage the business, design of the restaurant and put all of that to the test and see how successful you can be, right?
Right.
So I've always had that goal. And I was very fortunate to be able to find partners and investors to help me get to that point and provide me with the opportunity to do that. And it was tough.
Yeah,
it was really tough. I mean, I went in, it's a very selfish thing to do, you know, because it was really encapsulating my vision, right? Yeah. I just got married, you know, I was going to have a son within a couple months. So everything was about the restaurant. And that restaurant was going to be my bread and butter to be able to provide for my family too, right? And hopefully make it this great thing for the future. So you put all your eggs in your basket and some, if you got any feathers left, you try to put that in the basket too. And it takes a lot out of you, you know, but it was great because I put myself in a position to, I always wanted to cook for every single person. So the concept was set up so I could do that, right? But also at the same time, I wanted to showcase in Chicago something different within Japanese food culture. And sushi obviously has always been in the forefront, but there's so many different elements of Japanese cuisine that's exciting, just as exciting. So I wanted to showcase Robata Yaki or Yakitori 100% traditional to Chicago, you know, and that like the focus was just so traditional and stay, you know, within this box. But that kind of, that quote unquote arrogance or that, you know, to do that, like kind of put me in a difficult place too, right? Because it was the people that thought about Yakitori or Robata to eat on a frequent basis was a minority.
Yeah.
It wasn't majority, right? Most people, when they go out to eat, they're thinking about, ooh, it's Italian or steakhouse, especially in Chicago.
Yeah.
So Yakitori or Robata is probably further down the list. So I think there was a lot of things within the vision that I wasn't able to pivot quickly enough to maybe make it more successful.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you were talking about how obviously at that point, sushi had become a thing. It had become an accepted thing that people understood. I remember back in the 80s, there was that movie, The Breakfast Club, where Molly Ringwald brings in like a bento box and Judd Nelson's character is like, raw fish, you put that in your mouth.
Yeah.
You know, so back in the 80s, we still weren't exactly sure of what the hell sushi was, especially here in Chicago. Never mind that we're kind of landlocked. You know, and then as the years progressed, sushi became more and more of a thing and it was accepted. And then, of course, at some point, probably during the time you were doing at Sumi Robata, the ramen craze hit.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people point to Dave Chang as the kind of progenitor of bringing that to, you know, to America in terms of, you know, it's fast becoming a thing, you know,
yeah,
a friend. But you were at a point where you were kind of picking up something that wasn't well known and trying to make that a go. And I can imagine that you have a certain level of difficulty. Number one, explaining what it is to people that don't know. Number two, getting people to come in to try something that they don't know what it is.
Yep.
Essentially, it's just like, okay, you grill meats on 4th of July on your grill. This is it. It's just on a stick.
Yep. Yep.
Whatever.
So you're exactly right. I knew if I could get the guests to come into the door and at least try it,
right,
you're going to love it, you know? But it was that, I guess, the stigma. And I'm to blame for that, that it's like super traditional, you know, and these are the only kind of, this is the only spectrum of cuisine that I'm going to do.
Right.
Probably scare some people away, you know? Yeah. And felt like, oh, maybe this is going to be too, it's going to be like going to Japan Epcot, you know, with the girls in the kimono and, you know, serving, you know, typical Japanese food. But
no, I mean, I like I said, I really wish I had been able to go there. I always get upset when there's someplace I really, really wanted to go to. And it's like, I just didn't have the timing. But, you know, did you ever consider, hey, I'll move it somewhere else in the city?
I did for a brief moment.
Right.
But personally, it was, I wasn't in a really good place. Like,
gotcha.
not depressed, but just, you know, my marriage had fallen apart, right?
Oh,
I wasn't there for my son, for a lot of the time, you know, I was in a good amount of debt. So,
you know, that's always helpful.
Yeah. So really, really was the focus was to get back on track, to be able to maintain, provide for my family, and then, you know, get back on track. So that was really the goal. What can I do now to get to that place? And so when I closed Sumi, Prior to closing Sumi, there was a, you know, there's a few leads here and there, but none of the leads really panned out. They weren't ready to open up a restaurant right away. So I couldn't wait. So then I decided to do pop-ups I did like 4 months maybe. But the thing with pop-up is if you keep doing it, it's not so special.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can go, you start knowing that you can go there anytime. So toward the tail end of that was starting to go into the slowest quarter, which is the first quarter, right? Like January, February for restaurants anyway. So I'm like, I gotta figure out something. And then it just happened that the old restaurant group that I used to work for, they needed a head chef in Charlotte, back at the same restaurant that I opened.
That's cool.
Yeah, so I ended up going there. And I was actually excited because Charlotte is a great place to raise a family. So I'm like, hey, maybe I could settle down in Charlotte. There was two of my Japanese purveyors here in Chicago were actually delivering to Charlotte. So I was like, oh, this is great. I can really start pushing Japanese food in Charlotte. Because when I was there as a young person, there was no Japanese purveyors, right? So I didn't have the accessibility to get really great Japanese fish, dry goods and things like that to really make great Japanese food. So now I have the opportunity. So I was really excited for that. So was down there, we adjusted the menu and just kind of kept building. But I knew Chicago was home to me, and so I was still fighting to get back to Chicago.
Right.
A quick funny story. So when I moved to North Carolina, my son was still in school, so he has 6 months of school left. So I had to leave the apartment. I left Chicago, but I had to still pay my lease for the apartment in Chicago. Then I had to pay for my place in North Carolina.
Right.
So I'm like, man, there's no way I'm going to be able to keep up with these bills, you know, just on my chef salary in North Carolina. And the chef salary, I mean, chefs aren't so highly looked upon in Charlotte still, you know. So anyway, like, what am I gonna do? So I ended up doing Uber.
Oh my God.
So believe it or not, like, I work 5 days a week and then I would get off at 10. So after I get off at 10, I would Uber for 3 hours. And then on my day off, my 2 days off, I would Uber 14 hours straight. But thank God.
I do that. I do that myself on part time. And it's not like a ton of fun to work that much.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, nothing can be more difficult than Sumi and harder than Sumi, whatever. And then lo and behold, the universe, you know, showed you something else that could be, you know, more challenging. Right. But luckily, you know, Uber was there. I mean, I was able to at least stay afloat because that was there for me to be able to do on my time. The funny part of it was, as you know, customers will tip you based on their experience. So I was really making a great effort to be very hospitable, which is a huge part of our restaurant industry. Yeah. We're talking and, you know, talk about what I do, what they do, what they love about food and Japanese food and all this kind of stuff. So the customers that I was driving started coming into the restaurant that I work.
Oh, cool.
But nobody at my job, I never talked about that I was doing the Uber driving in my spare time. Right. They would come to me and say, oh, hey, chef, there's a guest here that said that you were their Uber driver. Is that right? You know? So everybody was shocked that I was Uber driving in my spare time. But yeah. These guests were coming into the restaurant, so it was kind of funny, but it was cool to see them come to the restaurant.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there is something to be said for doing it. It's an interesting way to meet different people sometimes. Yep. I've been doing it part-time for 7 years almost, and I'm trying to find something. I work from home for my day job. I do this. I do the, you know, Uber thing. But I'm trying to find another part-time job where I work from home doing, you know, something computer-related. Remote. Yeah. The 7 years of driving is, it's a lot, you know, it's you know, driving in general that much time. I'm thankful I've only had a couple of, you know, problems with regards to accidents and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
What was the, how long were you in North Carolina before you kind of started hearing up from Boca about coming in to take over Momotaro?
So I was 10 months into North Carolina.
When, barely left.
Yeah. And then Rob and Kevin, you know, the owners of Boca Group, they were huge supporters of Sumi as well, and Japonais too. So it was great that I had a relationship with them already. And then they reached out, you know, for an opportunity for me to come back to Chicago and help them operate Momotaro.
Yeah. And so when you came in, was Mark Hellier still there, or did you come in after he had gone?
I came in after he had gone. Okay. But he was a huge supporter of Sumi. He was like one of my biggest cheerleaders. You know, he would tell everybody's, and we had a great relationship. You know, he did a great job. He was very passionate person for traditional and Japanese cuisine. He had worked in Japan, so he has a very good understanding for Japanese cuisine. So it made my transition to Momotaro really easy, because he already kind of, the product that he was bringing in, you know, the way his, you know, recipes and the way the cooks were already taught was very similar to what I do anyway.
Okay.
And then he had a robotic program here at Momotaro too. So
yeah.
The foundation was already laid, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
So when you come in, do you just work with the menu as it is for a while and then slowly incorporate your changes, or how did that work out in the
beginning? Yeah, so the first month and a half was evaluating the staff, right? The team that was already here. A lot of times, well, maybe this is like the old way, but if the chef would leave, right, the crew, especially the crew that were tight with him, would also leave with the chef. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a few of those, and then there were a few people that decided to stay, but I needed to watch the team work and then evaluate where they are with their skill based on the menu that they were already doing. And then have individual conversations with each person. So they had a connection with myself. They understand in my philosophy, my principles, where I want to try to take Momotaro. And so that way they can make a decision for themselves if they want to continue on the journey with myself as being the new chef, right?
Right.
So trying to be really transparent, you know, to everyone within the team, especially with the back of the house. And then after that, like you said, just slowly start implementing my own dishes.
Yeah. Is there a dish that you brought on early that's still on the menu?
Yeah, there's a few, especially the robata, right? So right. The red miso lamb is on there. Negima from the chicken thigh on there. What else do we have from the beginning? The maguro appetizer, I'm not sure if you had that. The tuna.
No, I didn't have that.
Okay, the tuna appetizer, the baked king crab that's off of the Robata. There's quite a few items.
I didn't even notice the king crab. I'm surprised I didn't order that.
Well, next time you'll have to try it. It's great. Yeah. So we take the marrow section, the whole the center leg section of the king crab, and we take it out, the meat out, and then we break it into large chunks. And then I have this almost like an au gratin mix, Japanese au gratin mix, that we fold in with the king crab, and then we put it back in the shell. And then we sprinkle with the fried tempura shallots, and then it gets grilled, cooked on the grill. So it in the shell, so the shell starts to give off this really smoky aroma to the meat, and then the meat is really nice and juicy. I think it's a great dish. I like it.
I wouldn't be surprised, because there wasn't anything I had that wasn't anything less than really good, and everything else was great. You know what I'm saying?
Thank you so much.
You know, let me ask you, the one of the dishes I was awed by was the live prawn with the tofu espuma.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a holdover from the beginning, or is that something that came along with you?
No, that's something we just put on to this summer.
Okay.
Yep. So we were able to get in, it's a seasonal thing. It's something that we were able to get in with the live spotted prawns. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create a dish to showcase the prawns and the special, the what makes that prawn, live prawn, so special. Mm-hmm. Without adding too many strong flavors to take away from it, but I needed to also to give that dish volume. So the trick was the shrimp, it was super expensive. Like each shrimp is like $15.
Wow.
One shrimp, right? So I didn't really have much room to add so many more ingredients, because then the cost would be so outrageous that the guests would be like, what, for one shrimp? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not like I'm trying to be greedy and gouge.
No, customers. No, and you got to consider right now too, everything costs so damn much in the moment. And then on top of it, you're looking at food cost and overhead and pay, you know, staff pay and
right,
you know, everything else. It's like people don't realize what you have to include, and then you're posited in West Loop Fulton Market, which is a trendy and expensive on top of it.
Yes. So the trick was to figure out a way to add volume to the dish without taking away the flavor of the shrimp. So you know, the oven dried tomatoes adds nice texture, is sweet, and then the pickled onions adds a little acidity, and then the yuzu vinaigrette adds the saltiness with the white soy, and then the tofu, which is straight tofu puree with a little soy milk, adds that kind of mousse element to it. It's airy. It doesn't really take away from the flavor of the shrimp or all the other ingredients there, but it adds a creamy note to it, I feel.
Yeah, no, it's, if you're going to go to, I'm talking to everybody out there, if you're going to go to Momotaro, do it as soon as possible to get this dish. This thing is, number one, a visual delight. It's absolutely beautiful. It's just this lovely dome of what, you know, Chef was just describing, the soy, tofu and the soy milk.
Yeah.
It's and then the taste is out of this world good. And it's like, if I could order four of those, you know, like it would be ridiculous to spend that much money on one dish, but still it's a treat. It's a joyous treat.
Thank you, Dan. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, and everything was so good. And the other one that I was surprised, I'd been studying the menu for weeks, wondering what I was going to get. And one of the few last minute picks was the Wagyu beef tongue from the Robata. And I'm so glad I chose it because it was literally the best piece of beef I've ever had.
That's one of my favorite robot items.
And it's beef tongue. I mean, it's not, you know, skirt. It's not skirt. It's not ribeye. It's tongue. Granted, it's Wagyu, but it's stunning. What is the preparation like when you get the tongue in and how it transforms?
Yeah. So it's really simple. So have you experienced tongue like Latin cuisine?
Yes.
Right, and European cuisine, right? Within both of those cultures, it's stewed and cooked down for a long time till it really falls apart, right? But the gyutan that you had was actually from a straight raw steak. So we cleaned the tongue, and then we cut it where just the center part of the tongue is the portion that we use. So as it gets closer to the front tip of the tongue and like I would say the last third of the back of the tongue, there's not enough marbling, right, for it to be soft enough for you to be able to eat it like medium rare plus. So we only use that kind of center part, which has the highest amount of fat too. And then the way we slice it to kind of break up the grains within the meat. And then, you know, just simply season it with Japanese sea salt and a little bit of sancho pepper on the grill. And we cook it like medium rare plus.
It is truly it's amazingly heavenly, you know, skewer of food. It's
like one of the purest Wagyu beef flavors.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've had A5 before. I've gone to, you know, things and they've served A5. And there was something about this that was, it had that A5 quality, but it also had that very awesome American kind of steak thing about it too that I don't know how to describe it any other way.
Yeah.
It's another one I recommend. And then, you guys were so kind and you sent out the red miso lamb chops.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that's a hell of a deal. Those are two meaty chops for like $14.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a hell of a deal. And you get a good amount of meat on those. So those things are amazing.
So those are actually from Australia, lamb chops that we get. Super marbled, and then we marinate them for 24 hours before we serve it.
Yeah, those are really good. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I do want to kind of ask,
of course,
what is your daily routine basically like, and how much time do you devote in a week to the future in terms of what's coming up on the menu? And do you know kind of roughly a season ahead how far how much you need to change on the menu or how does that all that work?
Yeah, so I mean I'm involved on a daily basis with the restaurant. I have a head chef here that we call Chef de Cuisine. So he's doing the daily day in and day out operation of the restaurant. So I allow him and as well as our team to, you know, work on ideas and R&D things that they're also passionate about, as long as it fits within our scope of cuisine, you know, that we're known for. And then I just kind of feed them pointers to just to finesse the dish into something that is fitting for Momotaro.
Right.
Yeah.
Sense.
So you know, sometimes the dishes come straight from me that I work on, and then you know, sometimes it's when we're all putting our ideas together to do a huge revamp of a summer menu. Mm-hmm. We try to stay as seasonal as possible. You know, it's a little bit difficult for us because we're a large restaurant, and certain things become staples, and you know, we try to keep it on the menu as long as possible so they can always come back to it. But, you know, whenever the season changes, especially like in the summer and in the fall, we try to make a big effort to put on as many seasonal dishes as possible.
Right, because you're probably working with a lot of seasonal stuff here in the Midwest, or you know, Chicago specific, but you're also talking about Japanese food, which has its own, you know, unique seasons.
Yes, exactly. And also now we have to put into play the supply, the demand for the supply and the workers. So we've been having a lot of struggle with maintaining our ability to purchase certain brands, Japanese products. Because I'm very brand specific to certain things, like the brand of seaweed that we use and the brand of rice or the brand of miso that we use. And a lot of those particular brands for us are from Japan and only produced in Japan. So if we lose a supplier because they go out of business, or a lot of times right now we're dealing with, they don't have enough workers. So you know, they're running out of their product, and there's this huge 4-month gap that they can't provide us with, really puts us in a tough spot. So we're like juggling so much of that. Fishermen, they're not always going out to catch fish. So, you know, we don't have accessibility to a consistent accessibility to certain fish. So it's a lot of, it's becoming a hard juggling act.
Yeah.
Because we import so much.
Yeah. Well, just as a kind of a fun, I guess, final question, then I'll let you get back to, you know, work, which I'm sure is going to be a fun day, no matter what, because it just it sounds like you're just kind of, even though it's a job, I get the sense that you do enjoy what you're doing, but when you're not, say you have a day off and you want to go to a restaurant, what are your kind of typical joints that you go to?
As far as restaurants?
Yeah. What's your kind of, some of your go-tos for when you're...
Go-to places? So I enjoy going to low-key restaurants, like mom and pop places. Yeah. I tend to, when I go to fine dining restaurants or fancy restaurants, it's hard for me not to analyze what's going on. You know, why is the chef using this combination of food? Why is he or she serving it this way? Why is
service? You want to turn your brain off for a minute.
Yes, exactly. So in order for my brain to shut off, I go to a lot of these hole-in-the-wall places. Korean barbecue, I've always gone to Chosunok.
Oh, yes.
In Little Park. They're great. The food is great. The service is rough, you know?
it's almost inhospitable.
Yeah, exactly. They want you out when you get in. So, but I mean, that's you know, that's okay. Like, it's just humbling, you know? Say, hey.
It's amazing because it's so popular. And in the world we live in is so critical of things like that, but they accept it from places like there. Because it's like, well, you know, these are older people and they just want you to do what you're supposed to do. It's like your grandmother coming in and saying, don't touch that.
Yep.
This, go sit down, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, just, it's almost like, get the hell out of my restaurant as soon as you're done.
Yeah, exactly. And I've been going there. So my ex-business partner, she introduced me to that place when I was like 25.
Yeah.
I'm 45 now. So like, I've been going there since for 20 years. Yeah. And it's the same servers, you know, and they treat me the exact same way. No, not any nicer.
They don't care who you are.
Yeah. But it's great. You know, it's consistent. It's just to have a good time. And everything that they put out is, you know, solid for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's one experience when I went there and they were out of something that I always get. And she could tell that I was annoyed. And this was kind of like later on in my meal. And she told me that I've had enough to eat. So she said, you ordered enough anyway. Chinatown dim sum. I like to go to Mingxing.
Oh, yeah. I love Mingxing. Yeah.
So that used to be like kind of my late night place to go to.
Right, they're open very late.
Yeah, they were open very late. They're not that open very late anymore, but...
No, they were for a long time.
Yep. And I love... I'm not sure if you've been to El Milagro in Pilsen.
The...
El Milagro. So they're known for, like, they have the tortillas. You'll see them in the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah.
Fresh tortillas and the potato, the chips. But they have, they do this style of Mexican cuisine where it's the hot bar.
Okay.
Right? And they have all kinds of different stewed pork and
I didn't know this.
Beef tongue and mole. And then you could choose kind of how you want it, like on a plate or as a taco. But their taco is really unique because you know how most typical taquerias, they chop up the steak?
Right.
They slice theirs really thin.
Oh, and that's the way.
They char grill it, right, to order. And so they leave it in a big slice like that, and then they put it on the tortilla shells with the rice, beans, and then they do this slaw with cabbage.
Man.
Man, it's great. It's really great.
You've just hit me to a underground secret, I think.
Yeah, El Milagro.
Know about the fact that they have their own food there.
It's amazing. I've been going there for quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So the places like that, I really enjoy. I love Andros Taverna.
Okay.
Greek Mediterranean food by Chef Doug. And then my friend Tai Dang, he owns Haisu. He does really great.
That's also in Pilsen, right?
Yep, that's in Pilsen as well.
Yeah.
Does really great Vietnamese food.
Yeah.
We're actually doing a collaboration for delivery food for Dwell Social on the 21st.
Oh, very cool.
That'll be fun.
I'll have to check that out. Sounds very cool. All right. Well, Chef Cotto, I cannot thank you enough, number one, for my experience the other night, but for coming on here and giving me your story and making me laugh so much about Chun Sun Oak, because it's been a while since I've been there, but I almost forgot what the experience was like, and that was a good laugh. So
yeah.
I really wish you the greatest of luck. I hope to be in again as soon as possible.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate
you coming. Thank you. And you have a great rest of your day.
Take care. All right, bye.